Hello and welcome in.
First Science.
Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday living.
On Science Mixtape on Soho Radio. Good morning. You are listening to Science Mixtape with me, Matilda Hay. And I'm going to welcome myself back because I've been away from the studio for a couple of months now. This is my first show since the summer and it feels very good to be back. Well, in the wake of Hurricane Harvey devastating Texas and Hurricane Irma landing a heavy blow on Florida, there's no doubt that our weather is getting more extreme. From UK Christmas floods to Nepal's devastating earthquake, Haiti's tsunami and rising sea levels threatening the Maldives, we are all at the mercy of natural disasters. Or are we? Joining me today is Alan Kelman from UCL. Alan specialises in health and disaster research around climate change, with a particular focus on island communities and polar regions. His work covers three main areas: island sustainability, risk education, and disaster diplomacy. He's also co-director of the Many Strong Voices programme, one of the world's top 10 climate change campaigns, which was created at the Montreal Climate Change Negotiations in 2005 to raise awareness about the effects of climate change in the Arctic and small island developing states, two of the world's most vulnerable regions. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm very well. I'm so happy to be back. It feels great. Great to be behind the microphone. How are you?
Not bad, thank you. And welcome back. Looking forward to today.
So I wanted to start by asking you about something you wrote once, where you said that weather and climate change don't cause disaster, vulnerability does. What do you mean by vulnerability? What did you mean by that statement?
What we mean is it's about what society does to ourselves. So we say there are no natural disasters because it is about where we build, how we build, where we live, and how we live, not what the environment does to us.
So it's about the way that we are positioned within the world that we make ourselves vulnerable to the disaster.
Yes, exactly. So nature always has extremes and has always had extremes, whether it's the earthquake or the hurricane. We have the knowledge, we have the ability to construct and to plan and to live in such a way that the earthquake does not destroy buildings and in such a way that the hurricane or the flood or the rain does not cause problems. But often we don't. So that's why the disasters are about us, not about nature.
That's such a great way to... I've never thought of it like that. That's really interesting. Let me continue my introductions. We've also got with us in the studio today producer Louise behind the desk. Welcome to you. And I believe you have a brain teaser for us this morning.
I do. I've also been away for a little while. So welcome back, everybody. So today's brain teaser is, what can you hold without ever touching or using your hands?
It sounds abstract. Alan, you got any ideas?
Plenty of ideas, so maybe I'll tweet them after.
Okay, yeah, I look forward to hearing all your thoughts. We'll be revealing the answer at the end of the show, so tweet us in at Science Mixtape or at Soho Radio if you think you know the answer or just want to have a guess. And for our interactive section today, we're going to be talking about disaster preparedness. So get those thinking caps on and channel your inner doomsday prepper. But Alan, today, the music is all your choices. What are we having first and why have you chosen it?
Well, I believe that the first piece is really something which speaks to my main interests regarding locations. And it is Rachmaninoff's The Isle of the Dead, his symphonic poem, Opus 29. And this really is about the intersection of islands and disasters. So I like islands, which means I've made the decision and I have the privilege that I'm very fortunate to focus a lot of my research on island locations, island peoples, island communities. And very sadly, when we're dealing with disasters, unfortunately, it means fatalities. So we're looking at who is dying. Why did they die? How did they end up in that position where they were forced to experience nature's extremes and couldn't do anything about it? So this absolutely gorgeous symphonic poem from Rachmaninoff brings together islands and fatalities. It's actually based on a painting which is incredibly evocative in terms of how it brings forward the colors and the ideas of environmental aspects, where we build, how we build an environment, islands, and also people being affected by death.
Thank you.
Without policies and action to address the climate change, an estimated 100 million more people will move into poverty by 2030.
That just puts it into perspective, I think, what a kind of challenge we're facing and the sort of work that you're doing. That was a really, really beautiful piece, by the way.
Yes, I very much like it. I find it very difficult to listen to sometimes because it does evoke grief, it evokes difficulty, it evokes melancholy, but it does bring together the areas which I'm researching. And when Rachmaninoff composed it, he also brought in tones of optimism later in the piece. Although it is based on the painting Isle of the Dead, which really struck Rachmaninoff quite deeply and inspired him to compose the symphonic poem, there is also an accompanying painting called Isle of Life. And this is what we find often in disasters. When we're dealing with them, despite the challenges, there can always be optimism, there can always be hope, because there is always action which we can take.
And what is it that drew you to islands and got you to specialise in island communities?
I wish I knew that. What it comes down to is I've always liked islands, and I was very fortunate that I was then able to make the decision, where do I want to research, where do I want to travel? And it came down to islands. I can definitely justify it academically, because if we look at bigger countries, they have wonderful world-class universities. They have a lot of resources which they could, if they chose, put into research and helping people. The problem is that often they don't. Whereas islands, when they have maybe 10,000 people or 50,000 people, there might only be a few people with PhDs on the island. There might be only a few people with technical capability in a certain area on the island, which means that they don't have a lot of opportunity to work with disaster and development and climate topics. That means that if they ask me, if they want me, I can make a very positive contribution to helping them. Mm. Whereas I'd be lost amongst the tens of millions, hundreds of millions in the bigger countries.
Yeah, so you can have a real impact in these communities.
And that's ultimately what we're aiming for.
And I just want to share with the listeners something that you highlighted to me when we spoke before the show, which is that an island community isn't just like on an island like we think of, surrounded by sea. It can also be a community that's sort of isolated in a hard to reach mountain region as well, can't it?
So this is absolutely where we can learn so much from each other and exchange. And I also like polar regions, so it's sort of a balance between hot and cold. There are many Arctic communities which are islands also, but many which are not. So this is where we can transfer knowledge, we can learn from each other. And it could be the smaller landlocked countries, for example, Lesotho or Swaziland or Liechtenstein or Andorra. It can be these isolated mountain communities which you mentioned, or maybe it's just communities, say, on deltas. So they are effectively islands, even though we don't think about it. And this has led us to think of cities which are islands. New York has many islands, whether it's Manhattan or Long Island, Stockholm, Lagos, they are all made up of islands, so we can learn from each other.
What would be the criteria? Just a sense that you are cut off from the external world in some way, or that you have a mentality where you're a real group? What do you think defines an island?
Well, this is where we go into the academic debates, and we can start with a dictionary definition, a small piece of land surrounded by water. There are actually some legal definitions in international law, but ultimately, surely it's what people feel. How they think, how they live, what is this island mentality? And island studies is very open-minded. So we have these debates all the time. What is an island? Do we need island studies? Why do we bother? And we often get many answers with stereotypical characteristics like small, isolated, marginalized, but there are often more exceptions than the rule. So it's an open discussion at which anyone is welcome to join.
Fascinating. I wonder if we could say that, I know for a long time people have said London is very kind of separate to the rest of the UK. Maybe London's an island in the UK. Who knows?
Absolutely. An island of 7 million, 10 million people. what can we do together?
A large island. So I just want to drill down a little bit into kind of, you've got these three main areas of your research that I mentioned in my introduction, and just kind of unpack a little bit more about what each of those involve. So the first one was island sustainability. You're sort of trying to create and maintain a safer and healthier community for islands and isolated areas. How do you go about doing that? What does that work involve?
Number one, it's about people and communities. So we cannot just go in and say, oh, aren't we wonderful? We're going to bestow our brilliant wisdom and knowledge on the masses. No, we do not do that. We should not do that. We cannot do that. So saying, look, who's asking for help? Who needs help or wants help? And how can we make this an exchange? How can we work together? When I go into a place, when I'm working with the people, I often learn so much more than I can give. often what my role is perhaps a spark or a catalyst. Just get people thinking so that they can help themselves. Because ultimately, it's not about us doing something for those others out there. It's about us saying science is a process. It's an important contribution to society. It can and should be used to help people. Mm. How can we ensure we don't cause harm, but instill the ideas which we think are appropriate, which are accepted by the others, and move forward together for sustainable futures?
So what would be an example? You say you're the kind of spark that sparks the conversations. What kind of questions or how do you kind of go about generating those sparks?
Well, a good example is this Many Strong Voices program, which you mentioned, and it was started at the impetus of the Arctic peoples and the small island developing states. And they recognize that they have a phenomenal depth of wisdom, understanding and knowledge, but it's based on the past 10,000 years of climate, environment and society. Things are changing quickly, societally and environmentally. So they need support to understand what are those changes? What do they mean? What sits amongst the portfolio of options which they may have to deal with it without causing more problems? So a lot of it is going in, sitting down, talking, exchanging ideas, bringing people together. This is a formalized process which works in science. And so we can take some of these ideas and together with them, write them up for academic publication, write them up for blogs for the wider public, while ensuring that these conversations continue at the community level and then people act for themselves in their own way on their own terms.
That's amazing. So does that then become that kind of research around the islands? Does that then feed into your risk education area and your disaster diplomacy area?
For me, education is continual, and I'm always being educated by others, by myself, by what we do. It's all very well that I'm standing up, for example, in front of a classroom and lecturing to the students, but by making it interactive, by integrating different approaches and media and ways of teaching, it means I'm learning and exchanging. So risk education is about telling people it's easy to learn first aid. Go ahead and do it. It's easy to prepare for a disaster. Go ahead and do it. But it's also about me being educated about wider topics, about how to communicate, and about my role and science's role to try and create a better society.
Amazing. And finally, the third one, disaster diplomacy. I don't even really quite know what that means.
So we're looking at bringing together politics, governance, diplomacy with dealing with disasters. And a lot of times when there is a disaster in a conflict area, the media, people, humanitarian response is that we are going to come together. We're going to use the tragedy to move forward, create peace, and stop the war. We thought, well, this is wonderful if this is going to happen. So let's study it by looking at disaster diplomacy, with the unfortunate and rather sad result that we have not yet found a case of disaster diplomacy which works. What we are realizing is that when it comes to risks and disaster and catastrophe, there are many other factors which supersede political action than trying to help people and save lives. Obviously, this is not an innovative result. Some people will say it's a human condition. We look out for our own interests, even if that means killing people. I think that we can do better. I recognize the result and I accept it scientifically. The question we're examining now with respect to disaster diplomacy, how can we change human attitudes and values? How can we make ourselves want to help people? How can we fight against the impetuses towards saying we want conflict, we want hate, we want injustice? How can we bring everyone together and say, we've one planet, we've one species, let's work together for diplomacy and to stop disasters?
Yeah, I think that's one of the biggest challenges of our generation is, I mean, we have all of these global challenges in terms of sort of climate change or food scarcity or lots of things on the horizon. And how do we learn to work as such a big unit when actually in terms of evolution, we're used to working in much smaller groups and, like you say, just kind of looking out for us and our kin?
And this is where we know we actually have the resources, we have the abilities, we have the knowledge. So in disaster research, whether it's islands or elsewhere, in diplomacy research, whether it's islands or elsewhere, we are saying, how do we change these values? how do we change these behaviors? How do we change these attitudes to say we face these challenges? It's not the weather per se. It's not the earthquake. It's not climate change per se. It's what we are doing to each other. So can we come together, join forces and say, let's move forward together with wisdom, with knowledge, with science, just with humanity?
And you say you're looking at how can we do this? Do you have any like preliminary answers to that question?
A lot of it seems to start with the risk education concept, which we were talking about, that children often do not have these presupposed value judgments. So working with early childhood educators, working with youth, recognizing what happens as we grow up seems to be the fundamental way of changing things. And you alluded to our generation and what we're trying to do with ourselves and with our peers. And if we're going to start when we are all young, and even earlier, whether it's in the womb or preschool or primary school, then perhaps that is a way to fundamentally change how we deal with each other and therefore move forward to working to solve the disaster problem, which is fundamentally a problem about people's behavior.
I think that's the perfect time for your second song.
Which is actually about youth. So this one, which I've selected, is by the Swedish singer Leila. It's called Some Die Young.
I will tell your story if you die. I will tell your story and keep you alive the best I can. I will tell them to the children. If we have some, if we have some. But I've always felt the feeling we would die young. Some die young.
It is estimated that individuals aged 65 and older represented over 70% of the fatalities from Hurricane Katrina.
So we didn't fully introduce why you picked that song.
It is a gorgeous song with beautiful, lively, inspiring music, but yet it's about death and grief. And in fact, it's perhaps about the worst death which people can experience, the death of a child. Although some say that if it's a grandchild, then the grandparent not only is dealing with the death of a young one, but also unable to protect their own child from grief and loss. This song actually became the unofficial anthem after the massacre on 22nd July 2011 in Norway, when the perpetrator set off a bomb in the center of Oslo, killing 8 people, and then went out to the island of Utøya and started executing children, with 69 dead. So despite the fact that this was an absolutely horrific, terrible situation, which should never have happened and which we never want to see repeated, this song came to represent the fact that we can grow from it. We can learn from it. We can do better. And this, in effect, is a story of loss, of grief, and of disaster, but doing better.
Gosh, that sent shivers down my spine when you said about it being the anthem. Oh, wow. It's like a celebration as well of the lives that they didn't get to live, but what they'd lived so far. Moving on from that then, from one disaster to an imagined one. So for our interactive section today, we're asking you, are you ready for disaster? So listeners, if you're at home, wherever you are, if you're walking on the street, maybe not so much, but if you're in a room, imagine, try and work out, how would you survive if you had to spend 2 weeks in that room? You couldn't leave because some disaster had struck. What do you have around you? What resources could you use to help you? We're going to play this game in the studio and we're going to use Ilan's great knowledge. So Ilan, I'm looking around me. And first of all, first thing I'm going to say is that we are very lucky at Soho Radio because we have a secret door with a toilet and a sink. So we have water.
That's good, right?
That's a very good beginning. But how much water is there?
Well, it's a tap, so free-flowing unless the disaster somehow destroys the pipes.
This is a challenge. When we say that you need to be prepared to be on your own for 2 weeks, we're talking about without outside help. So this will be electricity out. This will be water out.
Okay.
This will be no way to bring in food from the outside or communications or support from the outside.
Right. Okay. Okay. So maybe we don't have water. I have one 500 milliliter bottle of water with me.
And I'm just looking around and I see actually under one of the boards, there is an unopened can of soda pop there. So that may last the four of us for a couple of minutes?
Yeah. Some sugar for the day. We have a fire extinguisher should the disaster cause a fire. We don't have anything really that comfy to lie down on and sleep.
There are a lot of clothes hanging around. I mean, there's a certain list which we say everyone ought to have to be prepared to be on their own for 2 weeks. And part of that is water to last for that amount of time, particularly for drinking, but also for cleaning and washing.
So how much water are we talking?
Well, each person will need at least a few liters per day. So that's going to be quite a lot of bottled water, which you then have to have stored and stored in places that may not be affected in case, for example, your flat or your room floods. Also, non-perishable food. So think about how much you eat. How much would you need to last? And if you have all of these wonderful spreads and sauces in the refrigerator, well, that may not last 2 weeks because if the power goes out, then they may spoil. So people will say, okay, well, that's wonderful. Let me stock up on canned food or tinned food because I have a couple of electric can openers. Well, again, that could be problematic because if the power goes out, you won't be able to use them. So it's about thinking about what you use and how you use it.
I guess actually you could try and make some sort of gas, like light a fire and cook on a fire, right?
If you have...
There is some wood. We've got wooden walls here at Soho Iridium. We've got some cooler wooden name boards. You've probably seen them in the photos. So we can burn those. Don't tell my station manager.
And then it's the same with candles. Do we want a fire in an enclosed space, which can spread out of control?
Or
and
use up our oxygen.
Use up our oxygen and then bring smoke. So unfortunately, after disasters, when people have their own generators even, there are often carbon monoxide poisoning deaths, which are part of the disaster. So we have to think of that situation and say, how do we be so careful that we don't cause more problems than we solve? I think what this studio has a lot of, which is very exciting, is communications equipment. Mm. Although we're broadcasting at the moment, without power, would we be able to receive? Would we know what's going on in the outside world?
Yeah, so this is something that I was actually, in preparation, I looked at there are these four questions that you should consider when you're trying to work out if you're disaster ready. And one of them is how we stay in touch with people. And obviously, we all rely on our mobile phones. Well, definitely here in the UK, most of us do. But if the telecom signal went down and you had no signal, what's your plan B for how you would contact your family and let them know you're okay or work out how to meet up with them again? Do you have a meeting point that you're going to go to? Do you have, I don't know, a flashlight Morse code or a telephone box? And do you know their numbers off by heart like we used to before we had phones? That really struck me, what would we do without signal?
And certainly having a family reunification plan is one thing which everyone should do, because we are well aware that transportation routes might be down. And even if roads are open, they may be completely clogged. So if you are a parent with children, do your kids know what they're going to do at school? Are the teachers and other staff members prepared? And the biggest challenge is every parent ready to be separated from their children for several days. That is perhaps one of the toughest things to do.
And to even imagine and consider.
Exactly. So these are the challenges we face. But personally at home, I have a wind-up radio. I have wind-up torches. So again, people will say, well, I have a battery-operated radio or a battery-operated torch, which is good. But
then
do you have
spare
batteries? Exactly.
Yeah.
For 2 weeks, how often are you going to use it? And a radio, again, only receives. You've raised the real challenge. How do you broadcast? How do you let people overseas, family overseas, or friends overseas know that actually you're okay, you're holed up, and you have the supplies you need?
Good old-fashioned message in a bottle.
Hoping that the hurricane blows the right way.
Yeah. This really highlights to me how we don't talk about disaster preparedness at all in the UK. I know in America, where they experience hurricanes more, there is a sense that people know you know, if a hurricane's coming, buy enough food for a week and all of that. But like,
but even that in itself is problematic, because why are people waiting until the hurricane is about to make landfall? Disaster preparedness starts now. It does not start when the hurricane warning or watch goes out, because at that point, prices may go up, whether it's illegal or not. People will be raiding stores and trying to grab up everything they can, so stores will be sold out. And it's not just about the hurricane, but an earthquake can strike any time in many areas. So it's about thinking now, when you've time, what am I going to do to be prepared? So if I'm cut off in the next minute, am I ready?
And do you think it's something that actually in the UK we should be thinking about?
I think everyone needs to think about it, which then introduces the issue of, what if you cannot afford to store that amount of food and water? What if you cannot afford to train yourself in first aid and keep supplies? Mm. And this is where we come to the root causes of disaster being vulnerability, not nature. Because it's easy for me to sit here with a reasonable job and being in the studio and being comfortable and say, yeah, just go out and buy food for 2 weeks and buy water for 2 weeks, because I can afford to do that. Not everyone can. So this is where society needs to recognize that poverty, lack of choice, lack of resources causes vulnerability. So how are we going to help ourselves as well as those people who cannot afford to help themselves? Mm.
I'm going to let that question hang there, and we're going to go to your song three. What's your
song
three?
My song three is by Lorena McKennett. It is called The Old Ways, and it's about history and learning, this aspect of risk education. We have 10,000 years of human history. We can gain so much from it. We can gain so much from other cultures. And this is what Lorena McKennett is speaking about in the song when she talks about how there is so much richness in the knowledge and understanding from others, and we need to be able to try and grasp this and keep it while also recognizing the need to move forward and to separate from each other. So it's this balance of gaining and losing, trying to do better with what we have, but not losing all the positive aspects which others can bring for us.
According to the WRI, restoring 20 million hectares, that's just 1% of the potential, of degraded lands in Latin America and the Caribbean would yield 23 billion in net benefits over 50 years.
I have no comment on that fact. I was like, cool, yeah, no, I mean, it sort of speaks for itself.
Yeah.
There we go. But Ilan, what I do want to comment on or really ask more about is I'm fascinated in kind of the islands that you've visited and what those experiences have been like. What has been the most kind of personally, you've visited everything from sort of Svalbard, I think you said, to New Zealand's Chatham Islands, Barbados, Rathlin Island, which no one else knows, is in Northern Ireland. And actually I've been on holiday there. Like, my great granny came from the beach across from Rathlin Island. Malta, Seychelles, Tonga, you've been to some incredible places. So what, which one has really kind of touched you and stayed with you?
Well, in fact, that fact really goes to the heart of what we like to look at when we're on the islands and what really stays with us when we leave, because it's about people interacting with their environment and doing much better with it. For me, perhaps the most intriguing island which I've been to was what you mentioned, the Chatham Islands, which are far away off the coast of New Zealand and not easy to get to. They encapsulated so much with respect to the challenges and opportunities of living on an island, to the fact that one wind turbine can make a difference, but also one teacher can make a difference. And if that teacher decides that he or she has had enough of the island and wants to live in a bigger city, that can be devastating for the smaller community. Mm. What was absolutely fascinating about Chatham Islands also is that they had gorgeous basaltic columns, which are very similar to Giant's Causeway near Rathlin Island, which you mentioned. Yeah. But Giant's Causeway is a well-known, well-trafficked tourist site, World Heritage Site. The basaltic columns on Chatham Islands are really not known that well. And so we have this balance that if we talk about nature and talk about preserving nature and bringing tourists in order to see this equivalent of Giant's Causeway, is that going to cause more harm than good? Is the disaster the fact that people want more livelihoods, want more money, want more people coming in? Or is the disaster that we let them have everything they want and then tourists destroy what they're coming to see?
What are your thoughts on that?
I think it's up to the people. It's going to be a balance of the internal and the external. We have to understand what motivates people, why they like their community, why they don't like their community, what they want, what they don't want, what they need, what they don't need. But at times, there also has to be the external intervention to say, hang on, wait a minute. Are you certain that this is going to help in the long term? Mm-hmm. Could there be another way? And again, as facilitators, not dictators, as sparks or catalysts, rather than authorities going in and telling people what to do, these are the conversations that we try to create on the islands which we study and work with and exchange.
And how do you go about that? Because I feel like that must be quite challenging, kind of rocking up in a community. I mean, do you have a contact before you get there? How do you go around kind of asking these questions? Are people willing to talk to you? Do you have to kind of really work and build those relationships?
It's all of what you said. It is so vital to ensure that you are welcome. People understand why you're there, that you're open and transparent, and that you're working with people who know the community. But anyone in a community also has their own interests and their own power games. So in the same way that we say that there's no such thing as a natural disaster, many people also say there is no such thing as community. Or perhaps a more mild form of that is no community is homogenous. So we have to recognize that there are always people excluded, there are always elites and non-elites, there are always those who are driving for their own interests. So one example was work that we did in the Indian Ocean. So we were comparing Maldives, which is an independent state just south of India, with islands off the coast of India, which belong to India, called Lakshadweep. And we simply wanted to know about migration. Why do people move? Do they think about moving?
So were they moving from the Maldives to India, or was it the other way around?
So the question was, if you are thinking of migrating, where might you go? And why might you do that? That means that we needed to work with the locals to first of all make certain it was a viable question and that we weren't going to cause problems. Second, to bring people together in groups for discussion. And third, to do house-to-house surveys to understand more about their lives, their livelihoods, their approaches, what they do. The fundamental question was, do you want to move? Where to? Why or why not? Mm. And these very basic questions simply opened up a whole raft of ideas, of issues, of interests. And in Maldives, a lot of people in the outer islands were thinking about moving to the capital. People in the capital or on the outer islands might potentially want to move to places where they know that someone lives there already. So there wasn't a strong impetus to leave or to go far, but it certainly was part of their thought processes. It was certainly part of what they think about their livelihoods, because fundamentally they would move for jobs, for social services, and for education. We found something somewhat similar in Lakshadweep, but the difference is that the main place which they would move to, at least initially, would be the mainland of India. So there's a big difference between moving from an outer atoll to a capital city atoll, as opposed to moving from a small island to a giant landmass with tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people. So we found a very strong islander identity in both Maldives and Lakshadweep, recognizing how much they liked the island, how much they liked being islanders, and this underpinned so much of what their thoughts were regarding moving or migrating or emigrating. So much was about liking the island and being an islander.
And wanting to continue that community. Because I know that there are, I mean, places in Spain, for example, where the kind of farming lifestyle, I think the kind of global community that we have now, you know, the younger generation are like, no, I want to go off to the city, or I want to move to another country and I want to not be farming. And actually, who's going to take on that those farmlands when the older generation get too old is a big question.
So this is a perfect analogy of different locations which may have island characteristics, but we may not think initially as being islands. Is a farm an island? Is there some sort of islander mentality in people who live in rural areas but are actually the literal and figurative breadbasket of our countries? So rural to urban, moving for adventure, moving for excitement. This is an idea which pervades so much of humanity, even people coming into London, which is a wonderfully international city and representative of the UK. So this actually helps and challenge many of the media constructions or stories which we hear about climate change's impacts. We hear so much about hordes of climate change refugees descending upon us. As the seas rise and the islands sink, there's going to be climate migrants fleeing their homelands. But in actual fact, migration is a human condition. People have always moved. People have always migrated. I'm curious how many listeners are living in the place where they were born or grew up. Certainly some, but certainly not all. So people have always moved and moved for many reasons, of which the environment and changes to the climate are one amongst a vast array.
That's a really good point. One last thing I want to ask you before we move on to your fourth song is that I'm reinstating one of my favourite things that we haven't done for quite a few shows, the fieldwork faux pas. Please tell me, have you had any funny kind of things going wrong, unusual stories from your fieldwork experiences?
Well, I suppose it's more about travel experiences and fieldwork per se. And certainly early in my career, I was at a disaster conference, a disaster research conference. And it was really exciting because it was a combination of academics as well as practitioners, a lot of emergency managers. And one day in the conference, I came in after lunch, sat down, and as I started the session, suddenly an alarm went off and lights started flashing. And I just assumed it was a fire alarm. So I stood up, walked to the fire exit, pushed the bar, opened the door and stepped out. And I looked back and everyone was talking to each other saying, "Oh, is this a fire alarm? Oh, do you think we need to evacuate?" And so it was interesting that sometimes we know the theory, we're in a professional environment, but we just forget. So our actions are perhaps not the most appropriate. And just the number of times someone has sort of asked me, "Oh, is that fire alarm? Do you think that it's actually real?" And the lesson is, whenever fire alarm goes off, evacuate the building calmly and carefully. There's no need to run. There's no need to have any form of panic whatsoever. But assume that every fire alarm is real.
So you kind of led the charge there.
Well, eventually people wandered out. I wouldn't exactly say I was a leader. I just did what I thought was appropriate. And I think that my subsequent experience has shown that that's how one should behave when a fire alarm goes off.
Absolutely. Time for song number four.
Okay, so this is a composition by Tan Dunn. It's called The Tears of Nature and comes in three movements. The first is Thread of Nature, the second is Tears of Nature, the third is Dance of Nature. And the reason I picked it is because of its color and its texture. It's very much a percussion piece and provides a lot of opportunity for any percussionist to give all sorts of musical perspectives, musical cultures, musical dynamics. It represents nature's ideas of what we are doing to nature and to ourselves. So by engineering rivers, we often create vulnerability or make floods worse. By changing, as we heard earlier, the wetlands and the coastline, we can cause major problems for communities along those coastlines. So Tears of Nature is both about the damage we are doing and the ways that we can try and overcome this damage.
News just in. LIGO scientists win award for spotting gravitational waves.
And this coming Friday is the annual International Day for Disaster Reduction.
There's a new app to predict zombie epidemics.
Lord Howe Island insect is back from the dead. Declared extinct in 1920, it's now been rediscovered.
Hurricane Nate has hit several countries in Central America and is now has its lines on the Gulf Coast.
You will never be late ever again with the new atom clock.
Amazing. So I'm just going to kick off here with the LIGO story for winning the Nobel Prize. Rainer Weiss, Barry Barish and Kip Thorne have won the Nobel Prize after spotting huge gravitational waves flowing throughout the universe last year. Now, this discovery was claimed to be the discovery of the century, like more important than the Higgs boson even. And it's so important because it's proved one of Einstein's wildest theories to be right. His theory about general relativity, suggesting that gravity results from curves in space and time. And that predicted that if that was true, you would see gravitational waves flowing through the universe and distorting things in their paths. And they built this giant instrument. Apparently, it's the most sensitive instrument ever devised by man. It's like, essentially, I think the way it works is like two lasers kind of being mirrored back to each other over this like kilometer long distance. And so if any tiny, tiny, tiny shift like affected the mirrors, then the reflection would be like not perfect over the many reflections. I think that's how it worked in my...
Sounds very complicated.
Lower physical understanding. I just think that's really exciting that they have managed to detect gravity, this thing that we can't feel. We can just see that it makes things drop. Like, they've managed to detect it.
And that's really cool. Prize.
Tell me about your story.
So I suppose mine kind of relates. So there's a new type of atom clock. So there were clocks already in existence that were... already doing similar things, but they were off by sort of, you know, by a few seconds over tens of billions of years. Whereas this one is actually precise enough that it will only be off by 1 second over 90 billion years. So that's a massive, massive leap.
No more leap seconds. Leap years and leap days, I think we still have. But when we started this show in 2015, there was a leap second, which is okay. Where they like recalibrate with the atomic clock because it becomes out by a second. And then we had a big
It's a big day then.
What
I
was everyone like going to do with their leap second?
It's been taken away.
Yeah, no more.
So there were some researchers at GILA, in America, and they used a combination of strontium atoms. And for anyone who doesn't know what strontium is, it's an alkaline earth metal similar to calcium. An array of laser beams. Again, laser beams. We're all into laser beams in today's show.
That's basically what physics is, right?
Yeah, laser beams. To create a clock so precise, yeah, that it might be able to measure the interaction of gravity at smaller scales than ever before. So again, gravity, laser beams, it's all... They are the key things
TikTok,
in science
TikTok.
Right now.
Elan, I didn't even know there was such a thing as an International Disaster Day. Tell me more.
Well, we want people to act. We want to look at the positive aspects. So discussing death, discussing grief, discussing disasters may be a bit depressing or down, particularly for a Saturday morning. But there's always something which can be done. So the idea of International Day for Disaster Reduction is what we've been discussing. Comes from the music also. There's also optimism. There's high points. There's exciting points. So people should think about what can they do to help themselves.
So kind of like the sort of preparedness we were talking about earlier.
Exactly. The idea is that everyone can take action. What is suitable for you, and think about it before something happens.
And is this a new day, or has this been going for a while?
No, it's been going on for several years. Each year they have different themes, but fundamentally it's about saying, don't let disasters depress you. Look at the headlines, understand what's going on, but don't become one of those who end up suffering when you could have acted before.
And I believe we've even had a tweet in on on that note about the...
Oh, yes, of course, yes. My mum...
Shout out.
Yeah, shout out to my mum. Yeah, she tweeted in to say that, yes, it's been a very light show for a Saturday morning. She's about to go do the weekly shop, so she's going to have a lot to think about.
And that's why some
two
of the
weeks
tunes...
for our supply.
Yeah, absolutely. That's yeah, why Mom, some of the on. Tunes which I've chosen are actually optimistic, and they're about how to move forward and how to act. So we shouldn't ever forget the challenges which disasters bring, but we should also never forget what we can do about it before.
Yeah, human beings are incredibly resourceful, and we've already overcome so many challenges. What is your fifth song on that note?
So, moving into the next song, it is John Adams' Short Ride on a Fast Machine. And this one is brilliant in its composition for its minimalism, for its mathematics, but also represents a collectivity. The aspects of the song move around the orchestra, meaning that everyone is involved, everyone has to work together, and if you lose one part of that, then a lot of the piece falls apart, which is sort of a metaphor for society in dealing with disasters. We all must work together.
Was so rousing.
In the case of the UK January 2014 floods, scientific analysis has concluded that climate change had increased the chances of rainfall that caused the flooding by an estimated 43%.
It is coming to the end of our show. Ilan, you have been so fascinating. Your research seems to span so many huge questions. My final one for you is what are you hoping for the future? What's next on your horizon?
I would like more and more people to join us. So I'm very fortunate that I have these opportunities. I've met so many wonderful people around the world. And although I've witnessed a lot of problems, and it is so frustrating when we see the headlines come in of yet another disaster, we also know that we can deal with them. We can do it. We can stop the disasters. So I hope that my future will be bringing more and more people into islands, into risk education, into disaster diplomacy. Please come and join us and contribute whatever you can.
And it goes back to what you were saying right at the beginning of the show, right? Like, it's vulnerability that causes disaster. So prevention, not building on floodplains, having earthquake safe houses, all of that prevention.
Right, exactly.
Having food and communication and the equipment you need when the disaster strikes.
So even with climate change potentially causing more rainfall, that does not necessarily need to lead to more flood disasters.
Yeah, absolutely. We need to reveal the answer to our brain teaser. Lou, could you kindly remind us what it was, please?
So the brain teaser was, what can you hold without ever touching or using your hands?
Ilan, any ideas?
I would go for an attitude and a value.
Ooh.
Join Ooze in the studio.
Yes, you can. Have we had any...
We have. Twitter. We've had two guesses in. One from Adam hashtag Battleaxe, who said it's my attention, and one from Henry Lancashire that said it's my breath. So Matilda, do you have the answer?
I do have the answer. I just want to say, my attention is a good guess, but I don't know if you can hold your own attention. Something else holds your attention, doesn't
it? Could a mirror hold your attention?
But it's not you holding it. So I'm sorry, Adam hashtag Battleaxe. You were close, but not quite right. However, Henry Lancashire, it is your breath. You Woo! Can hold your breath without your hands.
Well done, Henry.
And all this leaves for us to end on is, Ilan, your final song. Which I will remind you, if you like, is Hair.
Yes, okay. So in terms of this final song, this was about the closing number to the musical Hair, which is called The Flesh Failures, Let the Sunshine In. And this is unfortunately a bit pessimistic. It's a bit melancholy and does have a strong element of hopelessness, because it is about sort of a statement of humanity and how we are often caught up in situations which we create combined with situations which society imposes on us. So although it is challenging to listen to, and it has a lot of discussion about the problems society creates, it's saying, look, let's never forget the problems we face, which means we need to find solutions to those problems.
What a lovely one to end on. We'll be thinking of you on Friday. Listeners, I hope you have a great Saturday. Thank you for joining us this morning.
We starve, look at one another, short of breath, walking proudly in our winter coats, wearing smells from laboratories, facing a dying nation of a moving paper fantasy. Listen for the new tall lies with supreme visions of lonely tune.
For more Science Mixtape, you can find our shows on Audioboom, iTunes, or any other podcast provider. Or join us live every Saturday at 10 a.m. on Soho Radio, recently voted the best online radio station in the world.